Okay, so picture this. It's the early 1970s. You're in Finland.
Right.
And I don't just mean, Helsinki, where you've got the market square, a little bit of traffic, some city lights bouncing off the snow.
Yeah. No. We're going way more remote than
We
that.
were talking way north. We're talking about towns like Tornio or Kemi, places that are sitting, just shy of the Arctic Circle.
Which means we're talking about a very specific and a very heavy kind of darkness.
A serious darkness. The kind that feels almost like a physical weight on you. The sun, when it comes up for a couple of hours, if you're lucky, it's more like a rumor of daylight, and then it just dips right back below the
It's
horizon.
freezing cold, and you've got that wind, that Arctic wind howling off the Gulf of
Oh,
Bothnia.
it's just a wind tunnel.
It is. It's a wind tunnel for these Arctic blasts coming straight down. And so you have this frozen, almost monochromatic landscape. And right in the middle of it all, you have these very distinct figures.
Yeah, these young American men, mostly 19, 20 years old, and they're walking around in suits and trench
Some
coats.
missionaries.
Exactly. The elders, or as the Finns would have called them, veli.
Right.
And we have this incredible collection of documents here today. We're talking memoirs, journal entries, retrospective accounts, and they just paint the most vivid picture of what that experience was actually like.
Yeah, and what I love about the source material is that it's not a dry record. It's not, we knocked on X number of doors and taught Y number of lessons.
Without a spreadsheet.
No, it's so much more textured than that. It's almost like a survival log.
It is. It's
Yeah.
just raw humanity. It's
Yeah.
got slapstick comedy. You've got high stakes theological drama. You have straight up survival mode. We've got stories here about missing trains, eating oatmeal with weevils in it,
Killing weevils, yes.
and even like accidentally selling holy books to buy coffee just to get through the night.
Which, if you know anything about the dietary restrictions of this particular group, that is a heavy, heavy irony right out of the gate.
Huge irony. But yeah, that's what we're doing today. We're doing a deep dive into the lives of these missionaries in 1970s Finland. And our mission here, it isn't just to recount the events.
Right.
We really want to unpack the human element. We want to look at how these young guys navigated a culture they barely understood, a language that is. I mean, it's notoriously difficult.
One of the hardest for English speakers to learn, for sure.
Absolutely. And, how they managed to find humor and these really profound connections in the middle of all that ice and darkness.
And I think the lens we want to use today, the thread that really seems to tie all these different stories together, is this concept of resilience, but also interconnectedness. Because when you read through these accounts from people like Bruce Ciralgi, Darwin Rasmussen, David Nagel, and all the others, you start to see this pattern emerge. It's about how these small, sometimes seemingly random actions, they just ripple out. You have these total failures that turn into these incredible bonding moments. You have what they thought were practice sessions that actually turn into life-changing conversions.
It's the butterfly effect, but with snow boots and those big fur hats.
Precisely. It's all about the nonlinear nature of results. You think you're doing one thing, but you're actually doing something completely different. And a lot of the time, you don't even realize what you've actually accomplished until maybe 50 years later when you look back.
Okay, so let's just jump right into the deep end. I want to start with a story that, for me, just perfectly encapsulates that mix of like sheer terror and absolute comedy. This is what the sources refer to as the Panakaku incident.
Ah, yes. The story of Bruce Ciralgi. This is a classic of the genre. You have to start here.
Okay, so set the scene for us. It's 1972. Bruce Ciralgi is brand new. I mean, he has been in Finland for exactly 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Just think about that. 2 weeks. He probably knows how to say hello, thank you, and maybe, where's the library?
Huh?
And that is probably it.
Right. And he's stationed in Tornio, which is way up there, right on the Swedish border. It's isolated.
Very.
And it's their preparation day, or P-Day, which
Yeah.
is their one day off a week. It's for laundry, writing letters home, maybe playing some basketball if they can find a gym.
Right. The day to recharge.
Except there's a problem, a massive problem. His senior companion, a missionary named Veli Beckham, won't wake up.
And this isn't just, he's tired from a long week. This is something much more serious.
Oh, this is life or death. Veli Beckham is a diabetic. And you have to remember, in the early 1970s, managing diabetes was a bit more analog than it is today.
Sure.
You didn't have continuous glucose monitors that beamed beta to your smartphone. Mm. It was this constant, delicate balancing act. And apparently, sometime during the night, his blood sugar had just plummeted. Yeah. He's essentially in a hypoglycemic coma.
That is just terrifying. You're 19 years old. You're 2 weeks into a foreign country. It's pitch black outside at probably, what, 10 in the morning?
Mm-hmm.
And your mentor, the guy who speaks the language, the one who knows where the grocery store is, he's completely unresponsive.
And Shalja panics, completely understandably. The source describes this frantic scramble. He tries to call another missionary, Aveli Marjanin. But can you imagine trying to explain a complex medical emergency in broken, two-week-old Finnish?
Friends sleep, not wake up. Something like that.
Exactly. He somehow manages to get the landlord involved. The landlord calls a public health nurse, and soon enough, they are in an ambulance racing to the hospital in the next town over in Kemi.
And Kemi is about 30 kilometers away, right?
It is. So just imagine that ambulance ride. The blue lights are flashing against the snowbanks. Everything is dark. This Arctic scenery is flying past the window. And you have this very real fear that your friend might actually die on your watch.
The responsibility must have been crushing.
It's an incredibly high-stakes situation, but they get to the ER.
And the Finnish medical staff.
They do. And just as you would expect, they are efficient, they're professional, they get Veli Beckham hooked up to a glucose drip immediately.
Okay.
And the thing about severe hypoglycemia is that the recovery can be incredibly dramatic. It's almost like flipping a light switch. As soon as that sugar hits the brain, the fog just lifts. He starts to wake up.
And this is the moment. This is where the story pivots from a medical drama into like a full-blown sitcom.
Immediately. Veli Beckham wakes up. He feels that sugar hitting his system. And the first thing he realizes is that he's underdressed.
Underdressed is a very polite way of putting it.
He's in his garments, the religious underwear that the missionaries wear. But because they had to rush out of the apartment in such a blind panic, he has no suit, no shirt, no trousers, no trench coat. He is lying in the hospital bed in his underwear.
So he turns to his brand new companion, Shelya, and asks the most obvious question in the world.
Where are my clothes?
And Shelya has this horrible moment where he has to look him in the eye and admit what he brought instead.
Mm. He says, I brought your clothes. But he didn't. In his panic, you know, he'd just grabbed what he thought were the essentials. He looked in his pocket, and what he had actually grabbed, the only thing he had brought, was a small yellow Finnish grammar book.
He prioritized language study. You have to respect the hustle, I mean, even in a life or death medical emergency.
But here is the kicker. Here is the part that makes the story legendary. The title of this specific book, you really cannot make this stuff up.
What was it?
The book was called Teste Tuli Panukaku.
Which translates to?
Literally, it means this is going to be a pancake.
Okay, I'm not following.
But idiomatically, in Finnish, panukaku, or pancake, means a flop, a disaster, a total fiasco.
No way.
Yes. So he is standing there in a Finnish emergency room. His companion is lying there in nothing but his underwear. And the only thing he brought to help the situation is a book titled, This is Going to Be a Fiasco.
That is almost too perfect. It's literary. It feels like something out of a scripted comedy, not real life.
It really is. And Veli Beckham, to his credit, just looks at him and says, you mean you brought your panukaku book, but you forgot my clothes.
The ultimate I told you so from the universe itself.
But let's analyze this for a second, because Shalja talks about this in his memoir as a really pivotal moment. He calls it a prophetic title. And in a way, it was.
Sure.
His first real crisis as a missionary was, in fact, a total fiasco. But here's the key. It wasn't a tragedy.
Right. It ended okay.
It ended okay. Some other missionaries eventually bicycled over from Tornio with a suit. They all ended up having this massive laugh about it. It became a story that bonded them.
It completely reframes failure, doesn't it?
Yeah.
If you can look back at a disaster and say, well, that was a total pancake, it takes the sting out of it.
Mm-hmm.
It stops being a trauma and it becomes a story, mm-hmm. an anecdote.
Exactly. And that humility is just essential for a missionary, especially in a place as tough and demanding as Finland. You are constantly making mistakes with the language. You're getting lost. You're getting rejected at the door. If you can't laugh at the panukaku moments, you are not going to survive the winter.
It's a coping mechanism.
It's a defense mechanism, for sure. But it's also a way of connecting. It humanizes them. It reminds them that they aren't, you know, these perfect spiritual beings. They're just 19-year-old kids with grammar books trying their best.
Speaking of connecting and things happening that you just don't expect, let's move to another story from Tornio. The story of Anne. This one gave me chills when I read it. It's less slapstick and it's more, I don't know, almost spectral.
Spectral is an interesting word for it. It's definitely about the unseen. This account comes from the writings of Darwin Rasmussen and his companion at the time, Tobin Rudd.
Right, the dynamic duo. Rasmussen describes Rudd as this really high-energy guy, a competitive former baseball player. He says they'd have these intense snowball-throwing contests and race their bikes against the Arctic wind just to burn off all this pent-up energy.
Which gives you a really good sense of their vibe, right? They're active. They're out there tracting, which is just knocking on doors, in this single-level apartment complex near the Tornio River. They meet a family who politely declines their message but says, come back later.
Okay, which is pretty standard procedure. Mm-hmm. And usually come back later is just a polite Finnish way of saying, please go away forever.
Yeah.
But they actually go back.
Right. They go back a few days later to teach what they called the first discussion. Now, this is where it gets interesting because Rasmussen and Rudd admit something in the source text. They say that they viewed this appointment merely as practice.
Practice.
Yes, practice. They needed to work on their Finnish phrasing. They wanted to get the repetitions in. They didn't think the family was actually interested at all. They were just, you know, going through the motions to sharpen their language skills.
So they were basically rehearsing. They were treating this family like sparring partners in a gym.
Effectively, yes. They thought they were the only ones in the room who really cared about what was being said, and they only cared about the linguistics of it.
Wow.
But then, days or maybe weeks later, they're at a member's house. The Marjanins, again, who we'll hear a lot about, they seem to be the anchors of the community there.
It's social hub.
Exactly. And they see a young woman named Anne. She's about 20. She's just come back from working over in Sweden. And she walks right up to them and says, you taught me the first discussion.
And they must have been like, I'm sorry, I've never seen you before in my entire life.
Exactly. They're completely confused. But she insists. And she explains that when they were at her parents' house teaching that practice lesson, she was in the back bedroom. The door was just slightly ajar.
Oh.
She was sitting there in the dark, listening to every single word.
The unseen listener.
The unseen listener. While they were focused on the parents, who apparently weren't that interested after all, Anne was in the dark, listening to them talk about the apostasy and the first vision. And she says that the spirit testified to her right then and there through that crack in the door.
So while the missionaries are in the living room thinking, okay, did I conjugate that verb right? Is my accent terrible? This is kind of a waste of time. A completely life-altering spiritual event is happening 10 feet away.
It just completely upends the whole idea of a target audience, doesn't it?
Totally.
We always think we know who we're talking to. We craft our message, our presentation for the person sitting right in front of us. But so often, the person who really, really needs to hear it is the one we don't even know is there.
It's such a profound lesson in not judging the value of your work by the immediate reaction that you can see.
Absolutely.
And the aftermath of this is just wild. She didn't just say, hey, thanks for the interesting lesson. She wants to get baptized, like right now.
Immediately. The missionaries finally realize what's happened, and they rush to give her the rest of the lessons. Rasmussen says they did all of them in just 2 days. She was just ready. She was absorbing it all like a sponge.
But there was a logistical problem, right?
A small one. The Marjanin family, again, the backbone of the church in that area, they were leaving town on a Wednesday for a trip and wanted to wait for them to get back so they could be there for her baptism.
But the missionaries pushed back on that.
They did. They felt this incredible sense of urgency about it. They set the baptism for the Tuesday before the Marjanins left. Just 3 days after they had formally met her for the first time.
3 days? That is an incredibly fast timeline.
It is. And according to the account, when they suggested that date, that Tuesday, she just broke down in tears.
Wow.
And it wasn't sadness. It was this wave of recognition. She just knew in that moment that the timing was right.
And what's the long-term impact? 50 years later.
50 years later, she's still a faithful member of the church. She served a mission herself. She has a family, lives near Helsinki. That one single moment of practice, that throwaway hour that they almost didn't do, it created a legacy that now spans half a century and multiple generations.
It really hammers home that point you made earlier about results being nonlinear. You put effort into A, which is teaching the parents.
And you get result B, the daughter listening in the other room.
Yeah. If they had skipped that house because they thought, oh, we don't want to waste our time on a practice session, none of that would have happened.
It really suggests a worldview where no effort is truly wasted, even if it feels like you're just going through the motions. You just never know who is behind the door.
Now, obviously, being a missionary isn't just about serendipity and these accidental conversions. It's also about conflict.
Oh, absolutely.
You're knocking on doors, you're challenging people's deeply, deeply held beliefs. And sometimes people push back hard.
And you have to remember the context. This is the early 1970s. The Vietnam War is raging. Anti-American sentiment is a very real thing in Europe at this time. And
sure.
Theologically, you're in Finland, which has a very strong, very established Lutheran tradition. Mm. So these young guys in suits, they represent a lot of different things that people might be angry or suspicious about.
Now, we have two just fascinating accounts of these kinds of theological debates, one involving what I'm calling scriptural Aikido, and another that hinges on a very specific translation issue. Let's start with the scriptural Aikido. This is Dane Bounds and our friend Vili Rasmussen again, right?
Yes, this is early 1973, still in Tornio. They show up for a family home evening with a couple they're teaching, an investigating couple. They probably have their flannel board ready. You know, they're expecting a nice, quiet, spiritual evening.
But when they walk in, it's an ambush.
It's a complete ambush. The couple had invited a specialist, a theologian from a local Protestant church. His sole purpose for being there was to disprove the missionaries. He was a ringer.
Oh, that is so awkward. So you walk in, you're expecting milk and cookies, and instead there's a guy there basically cracking his knuckles, ready to tear you apart theologically.
And he starts right in. He grabs their teaching manual. He starts mocking a lesson about war again, leveraging that Vietnam context to attack their moral standing. He mocks their doctrine, but then he lands on the big one, the concept of becoming gods.
Which is a pretty distinct, and for many, a very controversial Latter-day Saint doctrine. The idea that humans can progress to eventually become like God.
Right. It's known as theosis in some other Christian traditions, but it's very specific in Mormon theology. And this specialist, he demands, show me in the Bible where it says that. He's being very aggressive. He thinks he has them completely cornered because he knows standard Protestant theology rejects this idea.
So what do? Do they get into an argument? Do they pull out a pamphlet? Do they get angry?
This is where the synchronicity kicks in. Bounds and Rasmussen just look at each other. And according to their account, they both received the exact same spiritual prompting at the exact same moment. The same specific scripture just pops into both of their heads.
Which one was it?
1 John chapter 3, verses 1 through 3.
Beloved, now are we the sons of God.
And it doth not yet appear what we shall be. But we know that when he shall appear, we shall be like him.
We shall be like him. There it is.
It's an incredibly powerful verse. But they do something very smart. They don't just quote it to him. They ask the couple, the investigators, to read it out of their own Bible.
Oh, that's a key tactical move.
It's brilliant. Because if the missionaries read it, the specialist can just claim, oh, you have a different corrupted Bible. But having them read it from their own text, the effect is instantaneous. The source describes a couple becoming so completely engrossed in that verse, they were frantically discussing it between themselves, that they completely forgot the specialist and the missionaries were even in the room.
So they just walked out.
The missionaries realized the work was done. The text itself did all the heavy lifting. That's why you call it scriptural Aikido. They used the opponent's momentum and their own resource, the couple's Bible, to completely resolve the conflict. They didn't have to fight at all. They just pointed and said, read that.
That is a total power move.
Yeah.
But it also highlights something about the intellectual climate of the time, doesn't it? People were reading the Bible. They cared about these definitions. It wasn't just secular apathy you were up against. It was genuine religious contention.
They really did. And that leads perfectly into the second debate story, which is from Ray Blevins over in the city of Vasa. This one is even more linguistically specific.
Right, the thou shalt not kill debate.
Correct. Blevins is talking to a devout father, and the conversation starts to get hostile. The father brings up the commandment, thou shalt not kill, as a way to challenge the missionaries about military service.
Again, the shadow of the Vietnam War is just hanging over all of these interactions.
It is. The father is saying, essentially, if you are true Christians, you cannot participate in war because the Bible explicitly says, do not kill.
It's a valid question. I mean, it's one of the oldest debates in Christianity.
It is. But this father is using it as a cudgel. He's not really asking a question. He's making an attack. But Blevins has this memory. He remembers a conversation he had years prior, before he was even a member of the church, with a Protestant minister. And that minister had explained to him that the original Hebrew word used in that commandment is ratsack,
And that means
It specifically means murder, not just kill in a general sense.
Which is a crucial distinction.
A very crucial one.
Yeah.
Thou shalt not murder allows for things like self-defense or judicial action or perhaps military service in some context, whereas thou shalt not kill seems to imply absolute pacifism.
Okay, but here's the twist.
Here's the twist. Blevins sees the Bible the man is holding. He calls it the Green Dragon version in his account.
That sounds ominous, like a Dungeons & Dragons module or something.
It was probably just a specific Finnish translation he wasn't particularly fond of, maybe an older or less common one. But he gets this spiritual prompting, a thought that just comes into his mind. That specific version has the correct translation.
So he takes a huge risk.
A huge risk. He tells the man, check your own Bible. I bet it says murder.
That's a big bet. If he's wrong, he looks like a fool and he loses all credibility right there.
But he wasn't wrong. The man opens the book, he reads the verse, and he sees the Finnish word for murder, and he just slams the book shut. The contention was over instantly. The argument just evaporated because the man's own text, his own authority, contradicted his entire premise.
It's like defusing a bomb by cutting the right wire at the last second.
It is, and it shows that these missionaries, they weren't just relying on blind faith. They had to be sharp. They had to know their stuff. Blevins even cites Brigham Young's idea of claiming all truth. He used knowledge that he gained outside his own church from a Protestant minister years before to defend his church. It paints a picture of a very rigorous intellectual environment. Despite the freezing cold and the isolation, they were engaged in a real battle of ideas.
You know, we've talked a lot about the spiritual highs and the funny lows, but I want to talk for a minute about the logistics of it all. Because sometimes the miracle isn't some voice from heaven. Sometimes the miracle is just timing or a train schedule or a lost item being found.
The logistics of miracles. I like that. That's a great category. Because in a place as spread out and sparsely populated as northern Finland, logistics are everything. They're life and death.
Right.
You miss a train, you might literally freeze. You lose your notebook. You lose weeks of work.
Okay, so take the story of Paul Sharman and Antti Laitinen. This one is like a geography puzzle.
It is. So Sharman is stationed in Rovaniemi, which is way, way up there. It's basically Santa Claus's official hometown.
Right on the Arctic Circle.
Exactly. He records in his journal that the whole zone, meaning all the missionaries in that region, is fasting for a boy named Antti Laitinen who lives in Tornio.
And Tornio is miles and miles away from Rovaniemi.
Right. And the specific issue is that this boy, Antti, wants to be baptized, but his father absolutely forbids it. So you have this group of missionaries fasting in one city for a complete stranger in another city. It's just an act of faith and solidarity.
Okay. So they fast. What happens?
Months pass. The seasons change. Sharman gets a transfer notice. And where do you think he gets transferred to?
To Tornio, of course.
Of course. He gets there, he settles in, and eventually he visits the Laitinen home. He meets the very boy he had fasted for months ago. He meets the father who has been the roadblock this whole time.
Must have been an intense meeting.
The source says they stay late. They're talking, discussing, probably pleading a bit. They stay until 1:00 a.m.
1 in the morning. That is some Finnish stubbornness meeting some American persistence right there.
It is. And finally, at that very late hour, the father just relents. He gives his permission.
And the result.
Antti is baptized later that same day. And for Sharman, looking back, he sees this as a divine timeline. He fasted months ago without knowing why. He was then moved to the exact spot where he was needed. And the permission came at the absolute 11th hour.
It connects right back to that theme of interconnectedness.
Mm.
The fasting in Rovaniemi wasn't just this isolated symbolic event. It was the first link in a chain that led directly to that living room in Tornio at 1 in the morning.
And speaking of chains of events and small things mattering, we have to talk about the story of the lost notebooks in Turku. This comes from Anne Torpo-Jonas.
This one feels so relatable. I mean, losing your work stuff is a universal nightmare for anyone.
It's so mundane, right? She and her companion lost 2 of their tracking notebooks. Now, for these missionaries, these notebooks are their entire operation. They're their brains.
Yeah, it has all their records, who they taught, who to go back and visit, addresses, maps.
Wait. Losing them is a complete disaster for their work. They look everywhere for days. They tear their apartment apart. Nothing.
So what does she do?
She prays, but it's a very specific kind of prayer. She says, essentially, if you want us to return to that area and teach those people, you need to bring the notebooks back. She kind of puts the onus back on God.
The ball is in your court.
Basically, yeah. She frames it as, we're willing to do the work, but we need the tools to do it. So the next Sunday, she goes to the shelf where they always keep the notebooks, a shelf she has checked a dozen times.
Yeah.
And there they are.
Just sitting there.
Just sitting right there. Now, a skeptic might say, oh, her companion found them and put them back, or they were just overlooked. But for her, the significance wasn't how they got there. It was the validation.
Right.
She calls it a witness that the Lord is mindful of small efforts. It's this idea that God cares about your lost paperwork because he cares about the work you're trying to do.
It's the micro miracle. It doesn't part the Red Sea, but it helps you get through your Tuesday.
Exactly. It builds your confidence. And sometimes getting through your Tuesday requires more than just finding your notebooks. Sometimes it requires cold, hard cash.
Okay.
Which brings us to David Nagel in Turku.
This story is my absolute favorite. It is cinematic. It has everything. It has rejection, desperation, improvisation, and cream of wheat with weevils.
It is the survivor episode of Missionary Stories, for sure.
So Nagel and his companion are in Turku. Their specific mission for the day, find a venue for a big district meeting presentation.
That should be easy enough, right? Just rent a hall or something?
You would think. But you have to remember, they're young, they're foreigners, they represent this small, sometimes strange minority religion. They walk all over Turku for 2 days. They go to prisons, hospitals, the Lions Club, daycares.
Oh, everyone says no.
Everyone says no.
Rejected by the prisons. That's harsh. Sorry, we don't even want you in here. It's just total crushing defeat. Finally, they find a kindergarten for special needs children, and the woman who runs it is kind. She agrees to let them use the space. Success.
High five. Mission accomplished. Time to go home.
But then reality hits them like a ton of bricks. They are broke.
Like student broke or ramen noodle for dinner broke?
No, like stranded in a foreign city with literally zero resources broke. They're at the train station. They need to get back to Rama, which is the town where they live. They pool all their money, they count it, and they are exactly one Finnmark short of the fare.
Oh, the agony of that. One single mark. That's probably just pennies.
And the train is leaving in 5 minutes.
What do they do? Do they beg? Do they try to sneak on?
This is the part of the story that is just incredible. At that time, it was common for missionaries to carry copies of the Book of Mormon to sell or give away. It was part of their routine. They had one copy left.
Don't tell me.
They go into the train station coffee shop. Now, missionaries are generally supposed to avoid coffee shops for obvious reasons, but desperation calls for desperate measures. They find a man sitting there, and they sell him their very last copy of the Book of Mormon to get the money for the train ticket.
They sold a religious text in a coffee shop, a place they aren't supposed to be, just to fund their travel back home.
Talk about survival instincts. It is brilliant improvisation. But here is the kicker. The final twist of the knife. They missed the train anyway.
No, after all that.
It pulled out of the station while they were in the coffee shop making the sale. So now they have the money, but the train is gone. They have to wait an hour for the next one.
That is just soul-crushing. You just want to sit down and cry at that point.
But they don't. This is what's amazing. They don't mope. They use that waiting time and the money they just made from the book to buy postcards. And they write out invitations to all the other missionaries for the event that they just secured the venue for.
They are relentless. They just do not stop working.
They finally get the next train back to Rama. They're exhausted. They're hungry. They haven't eaten properly in who knows how long. They open their food cupboard. What's in there?
Please don't say the weevils.
A box of cream of wheat with weevils in it. That is their only food.
That is the lowest of low points. You've had this glorious spiritual victory finding the venue, and now you are staring at bug-infested porridge in a freezing apartment.
It is the perfect contrast of missionary life, isn't it? The incredible spiritual high followed by the crushing temporal low. But then there's a second miracle, a final act. They check their mail. And there's a letter from Nagel's father.
And what's in it?
A check for winter clothes. He had mentioned he needed them weeks ago in a letter home. The money arrived on the exact day when they were completely destitute.
So they didn't have to eat the weevils after all.
Presumably they went out and bought some actual food, maybe a pizza. But look at that narrative arc. You have rejection, then success, then a crisis, then improvisation selling the book, then failure, missing the train, then despair of the weevils, and finally provision, the check from home. It's an absolute roller coaster.
And it creates this sense that, you know, they're being watched over, but they're also being tested. It's like the universe is saying, we'll help you out, but you got to sell the book in the coffee shop first. You have to do your part.
It demands agency. They couldn't just sit on the curb and pray for a miracle. They had to hustle. And I think that's a key takeaway from all of these sources. Faith in this context isn't passive. It's extremely active. You have to move your feet.
Active and sometimes, you know, intuitive. We have a couple of stories here that touch on this idea of knowing things you shouldn't know or being able to do things you shouldn't be able to do. The sources talk about the gift of tongues and the gift of intuition.
Yeah. Let's talk about Dame Bounds and his companion, Velly Jackson. This story is fascinating because it deals with, like, performance anxiety on a spiritual level.
Right. This is the story where the script gets thrown out the window.
Literally. The mission leadership had just changed the official teaching method. They moved away from the old Socratic method, which was all about asking questions, to new standardized, memorized discussions.
So scripts.
Right. But Bounds and Jackson were new companions. They hadn't had time to memorize the new stuff yet.
So they're going into a teaching appointment completely unprepared. They're going into battle without their armor.
Woefully unprepared. They go to meet a couple who lives far out in the country. They get through the first part, the part they knew from the old method, and then just blank. They run out of memorized material.
That is the ultimate public speaking nightmare. You're in a stranger's house, you're speaking a foreign language, and you just stop.
Silence. Awkward, heavy silence. But instead of panicking or just leaving, they said a silent prayer right there in the living room. And according to their account, the words just came. They were able to teach fluently. The concepts, the ideas, they just flowed.
And the husband, the man they were teaching, he noticed something.
He did. He later told them, and I love this, he said, "Your Finnish is not very good."
Brutally honest. You have to love the Finns for not sugarcoating things.
But then he added, "But after you prayed, I understood everything perfectly."
Wow. So even though the grammar might have been broken, the accent maybe a bit off, the meaning was transmitted perfectly.
Exactly. But I also love the ending of this story because it's not a fairy tale. The husband didn't end up converting. He was a very heavy smoker and he felt he couldn't give it up, which was a requirement. He eventually declined any further visits.
So why does the story even matter if he didn't join? Usually these kinds of stories end with a baptism.
Because for the missionaries, the miracle wasn't the conversion of the man. It was the confirmation of their own calling. They experienced a capability that was beyond their natural ability. It became a personal treasure for them.
Right.
It proved to them that they weren't alone in that room. So even if the sale wasn't closed, the experience itself validated their entire mission.
It sustained them. It gave them the spiritual fuel to keep going to the next door and the next.
Precisely. And then you have that intuition story, the one with Forrest Modishaw.
This is the perfect timing moment.
Mm-hmm. His companion of Valley Weeks feels this sudden strong urge of prompting to go and visit a specific family in Turku. There's no appointment. It's just a feeling. We need to go there right now.
And they were on a schedule. Right. They were trying to catch a train to Pori.
Yes. So this was a detour. They risked missing their train. They go out of their way and they knock on the door. And the family answers with these amazed looks on their faces.
Why? Were they expecting someone else?
No. They weren't expecting anyone. The reason they were amazed was because the family was in the middle of a crisis. There was discord in the home, arguing, tension. And they had just finished saying a family prayer, asking God for help to hold a meaningful family night together. And the second they said amen, there was a knock on the door. It was the missionaries.
You cannot script that. That is like something out of a movie.
It is the absolute definition of synchronicity. The missionaries acted as the direct answer to a prayer that they didn't even know was being offered.
So we've covered a lot of ground here. We've been to the hospital in Kemi. We've been to the river in Tornio. We've been inside the minds of these young men as they argued theology, fought off frostbite, and ate questionable oatmeal. When you put it all together, what does it all add up to?
I think it paints a portrait of a very specific kind of human experience. These weren't superheroes. Mm-hmm. They were just kids. They were 19. They forgot clothes. They lost notebooks. They got into arguments. But they were willing.
Willing to be out there in the cold.
Willing to be uncomfortable. Willing to look foolish. And because of that willingness, they became catalysts. They stepped into people's lives like Anne's or Auntie's or that family in Turku, and they changed the trajectory.
It really does go back to that Panikkaku idea, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The fiasco. Maybe the fiasco is actually the point. You have to be willing to risk the fiasco to get to the miracle. If Shaoji hadn't been there to make the mistake with the clothes, maybe he wouldn't have bonded with his companion in that powerful way. If Rasmussen and Rudd hadn't been willing to do a practice discussion that felt totally pointless, they never would have found Anne.
That's the profound lesson here. We so often judge our actions by their immediate, visible success. Did I close the deal? Did I win the argument? Did I catch the train on time?
Right.
But these stories suggest that the real value lies in the attempt itself. The unseen listener is always there. The ripple effect is always happening, whether you see it or not.
And the support system, we can't forget the marginans.
Oh, absolutely. The marginan family is like the Forrest Gump of these stories. They appear in almost every single one. They hosted the missionaries. They arranged the baptisms. They provided the transportation. They are the glue holding everything together. It reminds us that missionary work isn't just the guys in the suits. It's the community that catches them when they fall. It's the local members who feed them and translate for them and drive them to the hospital in the middle of the night.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into 1970s Finland, I want to leave our listener with a final thought. We all have practice sessions in our lives, right? Meetings we think don't matter, conversations we just kind of phone in, chores that feel pointless.
Or failures, things that we think are just pancakes, just fiascos.
Exactly. But what if there's an unseen listener? What if your panokaku moment, your biggest failure, is actually the start of a 50-year legacy for someone else?
It's a terrifying thought in a way, but it's also a beautiful one. It means everything matters, every attempt.
It means we should probably be a little more careful what we say when the door is slightly ajar.
And maybe, you know, double check that we pack the clothes and not the grammar book.
Solid advice for anyone. Thanks for joining us on this trip to the frozen north.
It's a pleasure.
Keep your eyes open for those green dragons and those unseen listeners. We'll see you on the next deep dive.